Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 78. Today we discuss Alvin Guldner's book, Patterns of Industrial Bureaucracy, a case study of modern factory administration, originally published by the Free Press, New York, in 1954. This is part one of the episode where we will discuss the author's presentation of a case study of a gypsum mine and sheetrock factory. To get the text and other associated readings, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, this is Pedro coming to you from Copenhagen.
Hi, this is Sam talking to you from Mexico City.
This is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
And this is Catherine calling from the beautiful rural Midlands of England.
Welcome, everyone. Today we are discussing the ultra-classic book, Patterns of Industrial Bureaucracy. The book was published in 1954 by Alvin Guldner when he was just 34 years old, I think. The book is based on fieldwork conducted in a gypsum plant in a mid-sized city close to the Great Lakes in the US. Another book related to the same organization was published by Guldner as well and focused on a wildcat strike which took place in the same time of the research. Guldner, together with the work of Peter Blau and Philip Selznick, fits together in what is usually called the Columbia School. And this group of authors have written foundational texts for organizational scholarship, and they have in common an interest for understanding how organizations, especially bureaucratic organizations in private and public sector, function. How do they work, really? What is distinctive about Guldner in this context is his ethnographic sensibility, his attention to the in-situ ways in which bureaucracy happens, his attention to the work activity of employees, the tension between employees and management, and the meanings and understandings through which people enact organizational structures. So if we were to contrast that with the recent episode we had on Selznick and his research on the TVA, well, Selznick has an analysis that's more based on the documents and looking more at the higher echelons of organization, whereas Guldner is concerned to the functioning of the organization across groups. And this is an important aspect of the analysis, which we'll probably explore more in our conversation. We see the organization through the stories people tell, through their own words and perspectives, so to speak, through the way in which they go about their work, really. And also Guldner, unlike Selznick, and also Peter Blau, studied an industrial organization. So he's bringing this conversation on bureaucracy to this other realm, so to speak. What is common, however, across these authors in the Columbia School is that they all follow on the footsteps of Robert Merton, which was their mentor and advisor. And they follow in particular in his idea of mid-range theory, that is, an effort to try to build theory that is close to phenomena. They also follow the general principles of structural functionalism of Merton. But Guldner, again, because he is also looking at the tensions and the differentiation that happens in organizations, he's much more aware about the conflict that is so prevalent in social life and organizations in particular.
Now, I was going to get into the book a little bit because, when you're talking about ethnographic sensibilities, I mean, this is not intended to be a comprehensive look at a particular organization. You're absolutely right. I mean, it was focused on very specific tensions, and the tensions, in some ways it seems kind of random because one section of the book was about one form of tension that they encountered and another section was about a different set. And then at the end, they sort of bring it all together to say, here's some commonalities, some patterns about how bureaucratic rules form based on these particular topics. So it sort of gave me the sense of that the research team went in with a very open mind What are we going to learn from this as opposed to coming in with a particular research question that we want to explore at the expense of, you know, not really looking at everything else?
Yeah, so maybe let's try to rewind, right? Because I think the very structure of the book reveals that, in which it is not trying to be a manual of how this organization operates, but tries to bring this very deep, detailed understanding of the operations of the organization in a more theoretical fashion to reveal some kind of puzzles, which are both empirical, but also have a theoretical significance, right? So Merton starts the book by dialoguing with Weber and trying to almost justify the relevance of bringing ideas which were, I think, at that point, particularly connected to the study of public organizations to the realm of industrial organizations, right? And he tries to say also and set up the investigation in this broad fashion, as you talked, Tom, and motivating that in an interest of going beyond what is called the red tape hypothesis, right? The kind of general negative ideas that surround the very concept of bureaucracy and trying to understand, well, how does it really work if you go and look at an organization, right, on the ground? And in doing that, he establishes some parameters which somehow guide his perspective. One is this effort to try to see bureaucracy not as a monolith. He talks about that we should not think of bureaucracy as this Gibraltar type of thing, right? And not as self-imposing and natural. So trying to explore and complexify some ideas of Weber from which one would get the impression that bureaucracy is simply consensual and simply exists, but say, well, what happens when we look at bureaucracy and understand that it works in a particular context, and is a context in which things, organizations are complex and multifaceted, have various areas, have different groups, and because in capitalism there is an inherent potential tension between those who own the means of production and those who only sell their labor, so what kind of tension that we may expect between managers and employees? And he's pretty much sets the ground into this kind of central tension, right, and asking, we expect bureaucracies to be effective, to provide clarity, and so on, but he asks, to whom and how it does so, right? And let's try to unpack whether and what extent bureaucracy can be concessional or not. And he focuses in particular on rules. That is that's what he means by bureaucracy. That's the aspect of bureaucracy that the book is particularly looking at. So after this broad brushstroke explanation of what is the theoretical goal, then we have a very interesting story in which we see how the bureaucratization of this organization came about, right? So he describes first how work was organized in the earlier days, so to speak, and he characterizes that by the expression of an indulgency pattern, which we could call as a very pre-tilleristic, craft-based situation in which people, you know, had much more leeway, that there was a very kind of almost like undifferentiation between what was happening in social ties and in communities and what was happening in the workplace. So this kind of very informal, indulgent type of situation. And then he describes how, with the arrival of a new manager that he calls Peel, this all changed. And Peel was sent from the central office and brought a higher bureaucratization to this setting. So he starts by telling the story of how it was and how it became, right, and trying to explore the reasons why this particular manager, you know, was forced or was interested in formalizing more the work, and we can unpack that as we talk, and try to understand how it led and how it happened. Then he tries to think how the process unfolded differently across the organization on the basis of the separation that exists in the work process. And the work process is separated mainly by the mine and the surface. So basically the people that are collecting the gypsum and the people that are processing that, which happens above ground. And he tries to understand why and how bureaucratization unfolded differently in these spaces. And main takeaway is that the characteristics of the mine, because it is more risky, because people have stronger social ties, because the spatial arrangement is such that made it harder to make the work more bureaucratic, that is based on procedures, based on a kind of an informal supervision, so on. And it took place in a more kind of interdependent craft type, team type of situation. Whereas in the surface, you know, bureaucracy found a free rein. So after telling the story of what's happened to the organization and trying to establish these different ways in which bureaucratization unfolded, then he moves back to this more theoretical type of discussion and trying to use all this material to think about rules and to think about rules in terms of not just their manifest function. That is a typical idea from functionalist analysis, right? So not only what is on the surface produced by some social structure, but also what is the latent one. And he talks about how rules have all kinds of latent functionalities. And more importantly, and I think that is what the book is mostly known for, he theorizes these different patterns of bureaucracy, right? Sometimes people don't realize that these different patterns pertain to the same organization. And these three patterns are what is called mock bureaucracy, punishment-centered bureaucracy, and representative bureaucracy. And very succinctly put, the idea is that there are some kinds of bureaucratic rules in which there is no consensus, neither from the part of manager and workers. So this would be the dead letter kind of rules. There are some in which there is exactly a conflict between workers and managers, right? And each group may try to use the rules upon each other, right, in a punishment fashion. And then there is a representative ones in which there is an agreement between both parts on their importance. And he gives the example here of safety, right, and tries to unpack exactly what is the origin of these different patterns. And interestingly show, to go back where he started, that whereas some time of bureaucratization was close to red tape, you know, particularly the one that was related to this punishment type, there was, however, one that was not. And I think that is the gist of the book, in trying to show that there is not only one kind of bureaucratization, that depending on the agreement, the understanding, the way in which it lands and is, you know, perceived and lived by people, it can be both, you know, negative, plainly speaking, but also there is the promise of being perceived and lived in a positive way. So that is, I think, the gist of the book. And I'm very eager to try to unpack all these different facets with you.
Thanks, Pedro. That was a very good, I think, summary of the whole book. And I think, I mean, I agree with you. For me, the value and the beauty of this book is in the emphasis that he places on people and on social relations, right? So I think it's great how we get to reflect about these huge ideas related to the theory of bureaucracy. But we do that by understanding first, you know, the context in which these people live. I mean, even at the beginning of the book, when he goes into talking about, you know, the metropolitan area and the community and, you know, like everything that basically is important for us to know of what workers bring into the plant. And then to understand the kind of, particularly, I think, the kind of pressures that workers are under and how the characteristics of the work itself affect how they come to adopt some of these bureaucratic rules. I think that's, for me, that's what's great about this book.
I agree. And I also like the fact that they did write it as a story where it begins with a particular change. I mean, you know, any story has, a good story has got a conflict, a central bit of tension. And he starts by showing how just that successorship disrupts what was a pretty longstanding status quo, the indulgency pattern as he described it, where just about everybody could have things their way, and there was no real particular competitive or commercial pressure to do anything differently. But it was very clear, the story of the successor, I found the name Vincent Peale very fascinating. I don't know if y'all caught up on that, but anyway, that's the pseudonym used. You know, everything was all pseudonyms, but I found it interesting that was the only one where you got both the first and last name. Everybody else was either one or the other. But anyway, so the successor enters, but then in the process of doing so, you're introduced just subtly to the environment of which this gypsum company, this organization, had with its parent organization, in which there was a sense of dissatisfaction. I mean, if you were to read just the setting itself, you would get some sort of an idea of, well, this is all idyllic, There's this very open relationship with the local town, and everything is going nice and smoothly, when in fact, the superiors up there were, you know, looking at this as an opportunity to inject some needed change, because they were not satisfied with the quality of the outputs. More than just a change of an individual, this was a symbol of disruptive change that Vincent Peale represented, to come in and basically change the way that the mine operated and thought about itself and thought about its, you know, how it measures itself in terms of what it means to perform well. That kickstarts the story. And from that, everything else has sort of made sense. It was it was very easy for Guldner to lay out, well, here are all the different things where the rules started to emerge from or ran into conflict with the old indulgency pattern of where everybody was comfortable.
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed the book. But reflecting what you've all been saying so far as well, just thinking about the context of the times of when it was written and when the research was done. So it was just after the Second World War, where we'd seen many examples of where bureaucracy really worked. And, you know, the imposition of rules meant that you got the desired outcome. So it was quite fashionable or even trendy at the time as a way of managing workers and by getting performance as well. So I think from that perspective, it's also quite interesting. And they had very high levels of absenteeism in the mine, certainly, and in the surface as well. And it wasn't quite, I didn't see the resolution to that particularly. Maybe somebody else spotted that, you know, what happened, we know what happened afterwards in the sequel, which I haven't read, by the way, and you might have read Wildcat Strike. We can tell what happens from the title. But actually, bureaucratization of it didn't work. The indulgency pattern wasn't working. So as a practitioner myself, I'm asking myself the question, what would work? What's the right prescription for this particular environment to get the desired results?
So I think the golden answer is, works for whom again, right? And I want to insist on that. And I think the book tries to be comprehensive, but very much tells the story from the perspective of the workers, because I think, you know, it reflects this fieldwork sensitivity of trying to get the stories and the lived reality of these people on the ground. And even the way the headquarters, or someone was saying, is described, is this kind of external thing, right? So the story is that these people were happy because they had some ownership in the way the work took place. At least that is the idea that Goldner tells us. But because efficiency was needed, because more control was needed, and you're very correct in pointing out the context. That was a time of reconstruction. That was a time in which these ideas were very strong. You know, Taylorism was rampant. I mean, arguably, it is still today in many places. Just look at McDonald's. But back then, it was the way of organizing industrial. And I think it's very interesting to see this shift, right? Which is, we take for granted many things. For example, the extent one should be present at work at a certain time. But just reading, you realize that was constructed, right? The way in which work life and personal life was much more connected. And if you think about agricultural societies, agricultural regimes, that is much more common, right? But industrialization, I mean, I think we talked about that in the Modern Times episode, had imposed this distinction and had to then shape people to live according to that. Right. And we can see exactly all this taking place here.
Yeah, I think there is, it does even reference it in the book that ruralism was on the wane, you know, was a point of change in society as well that the book reflects, which is very interesting and insightful as well.
Yeah, and I'm glad you did bring up the absenteeism pattern, because that gives a very, very good example of how, you know, the perceptions about it were so different between, you know, the industrial higher ups. And say, you know, its purpose in the workplace. When we think about, you know, what Guldner talks about, how dangerous the mine was, and let's face it, you know, mining, I think we all understand that mining is inherently dangerous. Some of the dangers specific to gypsum mining are really interesting. You know, unlike carbon dioxide and coal, we're talking about a case where you could die from breathing the gypsum dust if it's up against your face. You know, there were certain risks. It's not surprising that the researchers found all sorts of interesting behaviors associated with the miners that was a way of preserving their sanity, I guess, you know, as a way of protecting themselves from becoming run down, subsumed, you know, whatever, because, you know, it's not like you had a whole wide workforce coming in to replace these folks. It was tied to the locality. And so absenteeism is part of this indulgency pattern. Well, okay, you know, I don't feel good enough to go into work. And, you know, I promise I'll be in the next day. So I'll just take today off, that sort of a thing. You know, that worked well until it was determined, I guess is the best way to put it, that that was not working well. It was not good for maintaining consistent, regular levels of production. So this is kind of like the sort of context in which I think, in general, they looked at several different of these sort of sets of rules and how they came about as a contrast to the indulgency pattern.
Yes, absolutely, Tom. And I think, I don't know if it was the same for you guys, but I really like this idea of thinking about the adoption of bureaucracy as like problem solving. And it made me think a lot about like negotiated order, right? So it's like Pedro said, it's not about, you know, it works for whom and it's solving the problems for whom. So thing that he does, which I think he does really well. I mean, I agree with you that he's maybe the point of view of the workers is represented a little bit more, but he does make an effort to also show us like all the pressures and the tensions. And even he talks about the anxiety of the new manager, right? So I like this balance that he does of showing to you where like each group kind of is coming from and what are the tensions and the problems that they're trying to solve. And then understanding these three patterns of bureaucracy as the outcome of trying to solve and negotiate those problems.
Yeah, I think that's all good social science aspires to. And I think especially ethnography, which is based on living with the people in order to report, right, what you're observing and in trying to achieve this balance that is not a caricature and is also not individual psychological type of explanations, right? It's pure organizational analysis and deep social thinking in which we show what is someone, an incumbent in a role like that, would struggle with. And he tries to tell the story that the reason why there was an interest of the headquarters to be more effective and have things with higher type of control, and the use of bureaucracy was the tool for that. But also because the new manager faced so much resistance and was someone outside from all that kind of closely knit type of people, he could only depend upon these more formal instruments, right? All these more informal, normative type were not in his hand. He was literally a foreigner to that reality and therefore had to impose formal controls. And that creates a cycle, right? And he tries to describe that and how this is constructed, which I think it's greatly done and showcases beyond the particular person, but what the position leads to in a way.
And it also showed the challenge of coming on the heels of somebody who was not just admired, but loved. The admiration or the workers' feelings toward the earlier manager. And I think the researchers were very wise to show how this changed over time, because the earlier manager was not necessarily sanctified during his time. But the more that the new manager was, the more that they found reasons not to like the new manager, man, that old manager, what was his name? Old Doug, turned into a legend. And that was just unbelievable. It was really funny because I've seen that sort of thing myself at times where, you know, all of a sudden the grass was greener where before it was a desert, only because the desert you're in now is worse.
I wanted to say one thing, maybe it's on my own personal interest in the theme, of course. But what I also find interesting in revelatory in the book is that he shows some facets of bureaucracy that are taken for granted. So going back to this idea of absenteeism, right? This the separation of family life and work realm, the extent in which one is accountable to one's superior, not just one to one's peers, right? Which regardless of the organizational form, one would be more keen and organic or not, holocratic or not, this has become taken for granted, right? This has become the way in which one would manage and one expect organizations to function, right? So I think it's interesting to see how there is a history and how this had to be constructed to the point that we take it for granted today, right? And interestingly, some elements of what existed, such as a concern for welfare, right? Such as managing beyond just the goals of efficiency, but about, you know, creating some kind of social relations, whatever, attention to the context, in a way, reemerged today, right? So it's interesting to see how through history some aspects become central and some others decay, right, and become taken for granted.
And also how some things persist, you know, and maybe it's for a later discussion today, but there's elements of this that we see in, you know, so-called modern companies now and in tech and stuff where, you know, you're part of a family, you know, it's almost cult-like in a way. Your whole life is taken care of. You know, you socialize with all the people that you work with. You work really hard. It's effectively Tayloristic behind the scenes. And I think, you know, from that perspective as well, so much, and why it's so important that we read these classics, I think, is that, you know, yes, some progress has been made, but some things never change. They just, what changes is how they look or how they're perceived or how they're marketed, quite frankly, at employees.
Yes, something actually I never know what to make of in terms of like the patterns of bureaucracy that Goldner arrives to is this replacement of the, I think he calls it the old guard. So basically, I mean, he identifies, you know, he talks about all these informal relationships that used to define like management, but also the, I think he calls them the, like the lieutenants, right? So the, I guess it's the managers that are under the main like plant manager. I find it funny that that this new manager that is in a way implementing all these like bureaucratic formal rules that are a departure from this order based on social relationships and informal relationships, he kind of does the same, right? Like Goldner explains why through all the pressures that he's facing and this kind of need that he has for having people that he trusts and that are loyal to him and that can help him implement all these bureaucratic rules, he ends up bringing people that he trusts into these positions little by little, right? I don't feel that he picks up this point or this observation in the patterns that he identifies towards the end of the book. But I've always found it really interesting to reflect on this role and this importance of loyalty and trust at the moment of exercising control, even in bureaucracies. Which can sound counterintuitive because they're meant to be based on professional or technical or expert knowledge and all these other things. So I don't know what you guys think about that.
Well, I think I picked up on that as well because, you know, when I was reading the book and I was thinking about other circumstances, which I've been in, you know, probably get this into part two, where we talk about times in which we had leaders come in and, shall we say, clean house, you know, the basically... The senior leadership team literature is kind of what came to my mind because indeed, you know, the managers recognize that they can't do things alone. And if the senior leadership team is essentially allied against them, then, you know, there's not very much they can do. Now, that's not to say that bringing in your own team is necessarily good. I really liked Guldner's discussion about the lieutenant, but basically that lieutenant came in as an advisor, as an implementer, as basically the one to do things. But what happened? He became the lightning rod. He became the person that everybody came to loathe. And it was almost like, you know, we really hate this person because they're in front of him as a way of getting at, we really don't like this new manager either. But, you know, this is sort of like the effigy that we wish to burn in a way. So, you know, bringing in that tension between the senior leadership teams, the old guard and the new guard, was very, very telling. And it also, I think, sort of added further impetus to or fueled the creation of rules that became doubly unpopular because it almost was almost an overreaction based on the new manager's insecurity with being in this environment.
I was looking at my notes and I thought these elements of the story, right, in a particular way, that it's another argument to show how bureaucracy or any organizational form is not self-evident, right? But it depends on the socialization through which people come to take it for granted and understand that as a good, necessary kind of way to organize, right? And because organizations in capitalism are typically defined by this tension, then you need someone to impose those rules, that believes in those rules, right? And I think that is the central shift that Goldner's trying to do, to say that, well, it's not just because you create people are going to follow. Of course, you need to enforce that. And you need to have enough agents to enforce that, if that is foreign to them. But at the same time, what I think is interesting, and I think that's what you're hitting at, Tom, is the way in which formal structures end up being identified with particular people, with particular situations, with particular interests, and then they become vilified, they become perceived as positive, they become romanticized, whatever, right, the direction it goes, which I think is the core in terms of the argument and the patterns, right, which is trying to show that we should think less as if bureaucratization, formal structure, whatever you want to call, even social structures to some extent would be undifferentiated, would be homogeneous, but to show that it can be perceived differently according to all these kind of factors. Who is enforcing that? Is that a friend or a foe? What is the extent the rationale exists for that kind? To what extent I agree with that rationale and so on and so forth?
Why don't we spend a little bit of time talking specifically about the three patterns that emerge? You introduced them, Pedro, but let's unpack that a little bit even more. Because I found this to be a really terrific tool that I was immediately using in other places. It's basically in a table that covers two pages, 216 and 217. The mock bureaucracy was endemic of basically rules that everybody was ignoring. It's ones that were imposed from the outside. This is what he said. It was imposed on the group by some outside agency, neither workers nor management. Neither superiors nor subordinates identify themselves or participate. And the example was the no smoking law. It was imposed from the outside because, of course, this is 1954. Everybody smoked. Everybody smoked continuously. anyway, you know, so you try to impose a rule that negates something that everybody does. There's no hope of, you know, no expectation that they're going to really, you know, comply with it unless, you know, they're really, really forced to. And in this particular case, the only time that it was ever enforced, and it wasn't really enforced per se, was when somebody from outside, a safety guy or somebody else, was in the factory and was like, no, we can't smoke now, or we have to hide it from this person so that we don't draw attention to the fact that we consider this rule dumb. Okay, so mock bureaucracy, and I think they called it mock because it was like, it's fake. It's the establishment of a rule for the purposes of establishing a rule. The representative, which one would presume would be the desired kind of bureaucracy. The representative is when both groups initiate the rules, assume them as their own, which is to say both groups is superiors and subordinates, management and workers. This is one that everybody agrees to. And safety was the example because of violation. Everybody understood that this was a dangerous business. Safety was to be performed. And he gave, you know, when they went down into the mine, the researchers went down into the mine, they found a number of instances in which, you know, people were doing things on the behalf of safety automatically, instinctively, just, you know, doing things that would even take time away from what they were might have been ordinarily doing or whatever in order to preserve the safety of the mine. And there was no questioning it. So in those particular instances, you would have to assume that, well, the rules must be good, right, whatever, because everybody accepts it, everybody abides by it. It seems like the ideal kind of bureaucratic setting that we'd be looking at. And then the punishment-centered, which we can probably talk forever about. This is interesting to me because we always think about the punishments in a bureaucracy going from management down, but the researchers found examples of the other way, where essentially management being punished by the workers through bureaucratic rules because the workers are dissatisfied. The workers are dissatisfied with the leadership in some particular way, have some sort of agreements. So they force or negotiate with management for a particular rule that management doesn't really wish to do, but they want to keep things happy. So this is the punishment centered is where the rule is accepted by one, rejected by the other, or not accepted by the other. And so then it essentially becomes a constant effort at coercion of if it's accepted by management, it's coerced, it's forced on the workers. You will comply or else. And if it's the other way around, then it's the workers basically forcing management's hand to say, we need this, we need better equipment, we need better pay, we need whatever, or else we walk off the job, that sort of a thing. So those were the three lenses, the three bureaucratic patterns. It was very easy to come up with, you know, to think about those same patterns emerging in other contexts, which I think is kind of the beauty of the book. It's not just about this one setting. It painted a picture that was compelling for understanding organizations more broadly.
I think that's a very good summary of the patterns. And I don't know if you agree with me, but so basically the type of pattern that occurs depends on the type of work that is involved, or the type of task even that is involved. So whether it's risky or not, who has more experience or knowledge in navigating the risk or getting the task done successfully, and then the groups, right? So the different groups that might be involved and the kind of bonds or lack of bonds that might exist between those groups. Would you say that that's kind of a good way of understanding the difference between the three patterns?
I think that the tasks can certainly be one factor. I think what they showed is that there are different factors apart from the work itself. Going back to the example of this Vincent Peale and this and successorship, that personalities or the context in which leadership changes, or context in which the membership changes, which wasn't really covered in this story, but I think is worth considering. Those can also present instances where rules that might not have been needed before, because things were sort of happening instinctively on automatic, may need to be created in order to address the different ways in which people perceive not just the task, but also the work environment. One can imagine the end result of the work of the relationship between the mine and the local population was not really focused on once you got past the first couple of chapters to lay down the setting. But you can imagine how bureaucracy could have played into those relationships, whereas old Doug might have been just a natural, you know, go with the flow, talk with the people kind of a person. Everybody understands him and he understands everybody. And then this other outsider comes in and suddenly now we have to be careful about what we say. And their rules start forming about, okay, how do we figure out how to message what the factory is about, or what I'm about, or what's going on, and that sort of a thing. Something that would seem to be as natural as communication suddenly turns bureaucratic.
So I think that, again, points to one of, I think, the strengths or interesting aspects of the book, is that while it is founded and coming from Merton and all that kind of ideas of functionalism, basically the idea that whatever social structure aspect that exists is serving a purpose, right? And the goal of the analyst is to decode that purpose, but to show that these work in a kind of dynamic equilibrium type of situation, that these patterns are not fixed and they're not inherent to the rules in itself, right? So safety, for example, in a different context, in a different situation, or if different people staffing the role might, you know, shift as we were just hitting at, right? So it's not that it's per se naturally as such, but has to do with the relationships that exist. So for example, I was listening to you and imagining, I don't remember if Goldner talks about that in the book, but an important difference that Peale brought is that he would hire people in a much more formalized way, right? There would be the interview, there would be a criteria, then he would, you know, make a wide search, all the kind of things we take for granted in hiring, whereas the old dog would just go around the town and talking to people and, you know, look for what he called no troublemakers and all that, right? That is an instance of how a bureaucratization, a rule that came to exist because this formalization emerged and was potentially understood in a punishment or in a misaligned way, right? Because there was an agreement for only one part of what the way you do a hiring, for example.
He does that, but he does that to a certain extent. Like going back to the observation I made before about the, you know, the new lieutenants that he brings in. Like, I mean, I find this very funny because I see this in public organizations, especially here in Mexico, right? So you want to be formal in the people that you hire that will do the work, like in a technical sense, and you look at their credentials and, you know, like everything that this manager was probably doing. But then when it comes to the people that perform a function that is more disciplinary, to use Goldner's language, or that is more about control and authority, then you want people that you can trust. So in that, he didn't, like for that, he didn't hire, you know, based on maybe who was more qualified for the work, although I'm sure that the people that he hired were qualified. But it was like this idea of loyalty and trust also played a role, which I find interesting.
And when there's strong social ties, that loyalty and trust is a given. And you saw how tight-knit they were, particularly in the mine, how important that element of trust was, and how easy it is to have rules when that trust exists. Like for me, looking at the three different types, what came to mind in a sense of, you know, if I was, as Tom was thinking as well, I think of applying it to workplaces I've been in, is what are the repercussions? So, you know, with mock bureaucracy, the repercussions arguably aren't huge, or it's a personal choice, shall we say, even though we know now that smoking isn't good for us and kills us. But, you know, at the time, it was seen as not particularly hugely important. With the representative bureaucracy, there's repercussions on both sides to safety issues. So there's, you know, an impact on both. And then with the punishment-centered bureaucracy, it's more combative. And, you know, there's a winner and there's a loser element to the bureaucracy. And I think in practice, where in the workplace you can see that imposition of bureaucracy is not just about kind of, I guess it's exercising control and management, particularly in HR functions. If things aren't going well, suddenly things get very bureaucratic, you know, a very laissez-faire attitude to attendance at work and clocking in and clocking out suddenly becomes quite different when there is, you know, a need to deal with a particular work issue or people are looking to get rid of employees. You really see that being used actually in rules and bureaucracy being used in that sense as well. Peel had a very clear agenda and he was put in there for a reason. Interestingly, I don't think this book was ever meant to be a reflection on leadership, but it actually has lots of insights into the loneliness of the leader. You know, I think it's on page 72. There is kind of wetting my eye as a consultant who often goes into places to institute change and I'm on my own, mate. you know, there's a great description about him coming in untied by bonds of friendship to the people in the plant, you know, and how challenging that leadership is. And he was given no choice because he had nothing else. He'd no social capital. He'd no social ties. He didn't have the confidence of anybody he worked for. And guess what? It didn't work.
Now, I was going to say one thing I do want to ask about those, you know, about the mock bureaucracy, because one of the patterns that, you know, when we got to that part of the book and he laid out those patterns, when you have an organization that's sort of in a complete defensive defilade, I mean, it's it's all about fighting. We have a metaphor that we use. It's when I was overseas in a far distant organization, far, far away from the headquarters, we called it the 10,000 mile screwdriver. It was basically a metaphor of micromanagement. In that particular instance, you know, when I think about mock bureaucracies, I think about a lot of risk, especially for the organization who thinks they're doing themselves a favor by shielding themselves or attempting to protect themselves from an outside influence and allowing something that, you know, in their mind is not necessarily a good thing, but not necessarily desirable. But turns out, of course, because it is of interest to the outside organization, sooner or later, it's going to come back to bite. And then you end up with some real issues, heads roll, and it can get pretty ugly. I definitely agree that there's a yin and yang associated with each of these rules. Even the punishment-centered, which sounds horrible, reads horrible, isn't necessarily horrible. It has its place. It has its potentiality.
What do you see as the flip side of the punishment-centered bureaucracy? Because usually the narrative is one that is a negative one and the representative one is good, right? So I'm interested in this kind of multiple dimension of each one of them that you're talking about.
Oh, very simple. I mean, basically, if you have, let's just take sexual harassment, sexual assault, racism, discrimination, any sort of a bad behavior, something that has social norm, unfortunate social norm roots, that an organization, in order to be a viable one, in order to establish a positive reputation or whatever, has got to stop. And unfortunately, it's not the sort of a behavior that easily goes away, even in a representative case where everybody agrees on what the rules are. Unfortunately, trying to change the way that we relate with other human beings at that level to try to root out those types of attitudes is incredibly difficult. And sometimes the best way to do it is for somebody to be in a position to start removing people who with the wrong attitude. Or something else. It's basically something to say that this is not tolerated deal with it or go somewhere else, that sort of a thing. In that case, it's not so much about the task, it's about the outcome. There's a very clear, in that instance, we perceive that the outcome of the existing organization behaviors is unacceptable, and letting it work its way out through a normal evolutionary fashion just ain't going to get you there.
And I guess with punishment as well, like that can be from the employer or the manager to the employee, but it can be upwards as well through grievances. And grievances can be used as punishment upwards, as well as the punishment that we expect, that we associate with punishment that is always done on to somebody who's not a superior.
Absolutely. For example, rooting out toxic culture, what one would call a toxic culture, a leadership who's very clearly in the leadership job for their own purposes and not caring about the organization. That's an example of how that can come about.
So I'm listening to you all talk, and then some ideas are crystallizing how these different patterns reveal, in a way, what are the potentialities of bureaucratization, but also some pitfalls, which are almost between the lines, I think, in Goldner, right? So I just wanted to point them out. And one has to do, I think, with when we expect it to emerge, right? And I think Catherine was pointing out that when there are social ties, when there is like this tacit collective agreement and people are performing more or less the goal as expected, then there is no need. And I think exactly that the argument Goldner makes about the miners, right? In which one of the reasons that Pugh and the lieutenants did not really try to bureaucratize was there is this understanding that the nature of the work was such, but also that there were ties and there was, I think, a higher level of productivity there, right? So there is a sense that they were accomplishing the work in a different way, but they were able to do that. So, you know, we can let that go. In the case of needing to formalize the hiring or the relationship or the absenteeism was because the newcomer was able to, you know, communicate or deal in this more informal way. And now thinking of that and thinking, well, organizations have become much more complex, and complex and large organizations in particular have even less, I think, through the hiring process, a less uniform type of people that have, you know, a common kind of shared, I mean, of course, this can happen and so on and so forth. But I don't imagine that most industrial organizations today have this kind of reproduction of this tight need, everyone knows each other kind of thing necessarily, right? So once you have this more unknown individuals working together, then you need even more formalization, right? It's taken for granted, but again, because our society became more complex and so on, then we have to need to these explicit rules, which, however, and I think that is an interesting aspect to the flip side of punishment center, is the extent having formal controls can actually help us to achieve broader goals from egalitarianism, right? If you put everyone, you hire people according to a clear criteria, but also in tries to, as you said, Tom and Catherine, root out undesirable behaviors, right? But if you want the downside of something that seems as harmless as the mock bureaucracy, to go back what Sam was saying, is that because all kinds of formalization are used based on some kind of abstraction of how we expect work to happen, and therefore we try to discipline the way it happens, I think going back to the example Tom was giving about the 100 miles away screwdriver, something like that, right? Is that there is an idea of how people are accomplishing their work. And because it's so far removed, you may end up producing a procedure that stipulates some steps that are not relevant, right? And a lot of research has shown that the extent in which when you try to codify the tasks of people, many times you end up preventing them to do their work, right? And people have to like work around in order to get the work done because the formalizations are not really reflective to what the work is supposed to happen. And again, as organization becomes large and complex and try to formalize, then these gaps, you know, potentially can also arise.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some wonderful people for supporting the show. Sarah Otner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Kara Mustafa, Roberto Bernardi, Marina Timmer, Bernard Hogan,
Eddie Hunsinger, Fiona Knight, Peaks Craft, Timothy Paul, Willy Leidon-Wirte, Gabriel Van Bunnen, and Clara Lux. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website, where a donations button will greet you. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.